It's Friday, July 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, more details emerge about the airport attackers in Turkey. Humanitarian aid reaches all besieged areas in Syria. The top U.S. diplomat addresses human trafficking.
This is already an area where there are officials from all over the world, as well as the United States. They are used to the idea of security forces.
Is it a conflict zone? No, it's President Obama's future neighborhood. All this and more coming up on today's International Edition. Turkey says three suicide bombers who carried out the deadly attack on the Istanbul airport were from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Turkish officials continue to believe the attack was launched by Islamic State fighters, but did not name the bombers, who authorities say fired assault weapons at travelers and workers Tuesday at Atatürk International Airport before blowing themselves up. The death toll from the blasts at Europe's third busiest airport increased to 44, while more than 230 others were injured in the attack. Soner Kapcay, director of the Turkish Research Program at Washington Institute, tells International Edition host Ira Melman he's not surprised by the nationalities of the attackers.
We know that a large number of foreign fighters from Russia and the former Soviet states, including Central Asia, have unfortunately were able to go through Turkey into Syria in previous years and set up shop there, including joining Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front, as well as the so-called Islamic State. I think that the Islamic State picked those fighters with Central Asian and Turkic origins primarily because of their linguistic skills. If these people spoke Kyrgyz and Uzbek, these are languages related to Turkish, so they were probably able to, you know, move around more easily in Turkey than would have been the case for speakers of Arabic from North Africa or the Middle East, or people who came from Europe and did not speak any of the languages. And I think that definitely gave them the advantage of being able to move around the society without being identified necessarily because of their linguistic skills. And you also have the issue that, of course, Russia's northern Caucasus region has been a hotbed of radical activity. And when the Syrian war started, the Russians actually encouraged most of their radicals to flow out to Syria, because this to them was their way of exporting their jihadist problem into Syria. And now that jihadist problem, unfortunately, is being exported from Syria into Turkey.
So it sounds like that you do agree with the identification of those attackers as being ISIS attackers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what leads you to that?
Well, the modus operandi of the operation looks like this is ISIS. How so? Multiple attacks, simultaneous attacks, attackers who mow down people with machine guns in order to cause the most number of casualties and then detonating themselves. That's also ISIS MO, as we saw recently in Brussels and Paris and other places. So this is clearly linked to ISIS. And I think, though, the group will never assume responsibility. Let's be clear on this. Unlike in the West, and for example, in the United States and in France, where when ISIS carries out an attack, it goes ahead and assumes responsibility because this to it is propaganda to recruit unstable, violent-prone people from those countries. In Muslim-majority countries, ISIS never assumes responsibility for attacks because it likes to create an air of fog and suspicion. What do I mean by that? It carries out an attack, kills lots of people, one more, lots of people, does not assume responsibility. What happens next is in these societies, people start blaming each other. Government blames the opposition, opposition blames the government, suspicion rises, and soon you have retribution-style attacks. This is exactly what happened in Iraq. The mothership from which ISIS was spawned, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, carried out a large number of suicide bomb attacks in Iraq between 2005 and 2007, killing hundreds in each attack, never claimed responsibility for any of them. But after each attack, people started blaming each other in Iraq. The case was Sunnis versus Shiites, and that soon turned into retribution-style attacks and killings. And at the end, Iraq descended into a horrible civil war. I think that's the impact ISIS wants to create in Turkey by not assuming responsibility, so that it's hoping that the government will blame the opposition, and Turkey will be the Kurds and leftists, and they will blame the government. And, of course, then you're going to have this air of fog and suspicion, which ISIS loves. That's going to be the strategy moving forward. Should we see further ISIS attacks, they will not assume responsibility for such attacks. And I think in the face of that, Turks should be careful to avoid the Iraq trajectory. Instead, they should stay united against the face of ISIS threat, as well as identifying this group as a main and existential threat to their country right now.
Police conducted raids on 16 locations in three Istanbul neighborhoods Thursday, arresting 13 people suspected of having links to Islamic State. We turn now to check out what's buzzing online about the rapidly changing political scene in the United Kingdom. Our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. Boris Johnson, who led the campaign on leaving the EU, said he's not going to run for the Conservative Party's leadership. He said that in a news conference, and clips of that statement are trending on Twitter. Basically, he said, my role will be to give every possible support to the next Conservative administration and to champion the agenda I believe in.
Did he tweet about it?
Absolutely. He is on Twitter at Boris Johnson and tweeted a link to his full statement he shared on Facebook, and the Facebook post received more than 6,000 reactions. Many of his supporters left comments expressing shock and disappointment. And a woman named Charlotte wrote, I think you'd make a great PM standing for a prime minister. You are a people person and you care. A man named Matt left a reply that got nearly 8,000 likes. He wrote a very long reply that ended with, no doubt Boris will be back to lead the Conservatives once the chaff has been blown away. For today, he just dropped the mic.
Well, tell us more about him. What's his title?
He is a member of the parliament and the former mayor of London. Some media outlets tout him as the most popular politician in Britain. Now, Jim, I can't end the segment without bringing up some reaction from Nigel Farage, who is a leader of the Independence Party.
A very colorful politician indeed. Mm-hmm. What did he say?
Now, shortly after Johnson's news conference, Farage tweeted, the next person to lead our country must be someone who intends to help fulfill our potential as a self-governing nation. And most people thought that that's not too flattering to Johnson. Mm. Jim, back to you.
Well, thanks for the great wrap-up, G. You may tweet your questions and comments to @VOA_IE. That's the International Edition Twitter stream. Tag G and myself on those tweets with our handles @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Among the top stories trending right now in Asia, dozens dead, wounded in suicide attack on Afghan police convoy. Tough-talking president takes office in the Philippines. Hong Kong protest march seen as a test of views toward Beijing. Activists again see politics at play in human trafficking report. 2 years later, HIV-infected Cambodians appeal for justice and compensation. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. In what it calls a milestone, the United Nations reports humanitarian aid has now reached all of Syria's 18 besieged areas. The UN says this is the first time the besieged towns of Arbin and Zamalka outside of Damascus have received international assistance since November 2012. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN reports a 37-truck convoy rolled into the towns of Arbin and Zamalka Wednesday evening. They were carrying food, water, sanitation, hygiene, and other emergency supplies for 20,000 needy Syrian men, women, and children. There was, however, a downside. Jan Egeland, senior advisor to the UN Special Envoy for Syria, says one driver was shot in the chest by a sniper while leaving the area. He says the driver is receiving treatment in a hospital in Damascus.
But it was a very close call. And it shows how risky this work is, because there is no cessation of hostilities. in too many places now in Syria. So it is in many ways against all odds that we have been able to reach all of the 18 areas at least once and at least with partial assistance.
While the areas now have been reached, Egelin says he worries that the tens of thousands of starving people who received the first UN aid deliveries in January might once again be starving. He says people in Madaya and Zabadani near Damascus and those in Foa and Kafraya in the north near Idlib have received no further international assistance since then. He says another matter of great concern is the UN's inability to provide medical services and supplies to the thousands of people trapped in the besieged areas.
The parties to this conflict, including the government of Syria, has not been willing to follow international law in terms of providing doctors, nurses, medical organizations with all of the permits to serve the civilian population.
Egelin says the warring parties are blocking medical aid to people in besieged areas to prevent doctors from treating wounded soldiers who then might return to the battlefield. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States added 8 more countries Thursday to its blacklist of nations it says are doing the least to end the $150 billion worldwide human trafficking industry. The U.S. State Department put the former Soviet states of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan on the list of its 27 worst offenders, along with the fledgling democracy of Myanmar, Haiti, Djibouti, Papua New Guinea, Sudan, and Suriname. Kuwait and Thailand were moved off the lowest Tier 3 ranking of the annual listing, indicating they were making efforts to combat the trade in humans, but still under scrutiny. The State Department said that the governments in Libya, Somalia, and Yemen were too chaotic to be able to judge their efforts against human trafficking. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry called the devastating trend of human trafficking modern-day slavery, which claims more than 20 million victims.
When we talk about human trafficking, we're talking about slavery, modern-day slavery, that still today claims more than 20 million victims on any given time. And all 20 million are people, just like everybody here. They have names. They have or had families in many cases. And they are enforced to endure a hell, a living hell in modern times that no human being should ever have to experience. In some places, particularly where violent extremists are able to find a contemporary safe haven, and I might add a temporary safe haven, the atrocities are both rampant and overt.
Kerry highlighted the needs for focus on countries where violent extremists are holding men and women as slaves, calling on the international community to hold countries accountable to a higher and better standard of behavior in combating human trafficking. Kerry said a new model of contracts has been drawn up to try to prevent the abuse of caregivers hired by the world's wealthiest people. When President Barack Obama leaves office next January, he will be staying right here in Washington, D.C., and moving from the White House into a house in an historic neighborhood of the capital city. Newspapers have published pictures of the Obama's future home in Washington's Kalorama neighborhood, which was also the home of another U.S. president. As soon as Mr. Obama moves in, traffic will be blocked in the area, but for now, it's still easy to pass by his future house to sightsee. VOA's Bronwyn Benito narrates for Tatiana Karachenko.
He's about to go from commander-in-chief to couch commander.
What am I going to do in D.C. for 2 years?
This self-satirical video portrays Barack Obama searching for a new occupation. He tries different roles and hopes to at least get a driver's license. Obama has already chosen the house where his family will live after leaving the White House. After stepping down, he will move to a large mansion in a wealthy Washington neighborhood called Kalorama. The mansion has an estimated value of around $6 million. Obama will not buy it, but rent it instead, paying around $22,000 per month. Obama said he is staying in Washington so that his youngest daughter, Sasha, can remain in the school she has been attending. The Kalorama district is considered to be extremely prestigious and secure. The reason is simple. The area has the highest concentration of embassies and residences of ambassadors and other officials in Washington. Local residents are used to the constant presence of police and Secret Service officers. Neighborhood historian Stephen Hansen says with the arrival of the Obama family, this area will become even more secure.
I think the neighbors might actually appreciate President Obama moving to the neighborhood. One of the stories right now is that through traffic to the street will be closed off and only available traffic access to residents. And security will be heightened, so they will not have to worry about so much about turning on their burglar alarms at night because the neighborhood will be well protected. And ultimately, it might actually improve their property values.
John Horan, who lives near the area, walks his dog, Tiger, in the Kalorama neighborhood every day. He's glad Obama has decided to stay in Washington.
It shouldn't impact the neighborhood that much. This is already an area where there are officials from all over the world, as well as the United States. They are used to the idea of security forces, and they understand the politeness and the indulgence that we grant towards those that have given up a bit of their own private lives for public service.
Obama will be the second U.S. president to stay in the nation's capital following the end of his presidency. Woodrow Wilson was the first. He lived in the same neighborhood where Obama has chosen to live. The Wilson House serves as a museum for visitors. It is in walking distance from the Obama family's future home.
It's about 95% of the way it was. There are a couple of artifacts that weren't here.
Robert Enholm conducts tours of President Wilson's house. There are a lot of interesting things to see, including mosaics from the Vatican, tapestries from France, and in Wilson's library, an old film projector. Enholm sees some similarities in the decision of Wilson and Obama to remain in the U.S. Capitol after leaving office.
In some ways, the story of our house is also the story of presidents leaving office and remaining in the nation's capital in order to remain active in politics. That was certainly one of President Wilson's objectives, and I suspect that that's one of the things that President Obama will find is an advantage of being in Washington.
By continuing to live in Washington, Obama can't help but remain active in politics, certainly more than enough for an ex-president to do, despite the worries he expressed in his satirical video. For Tatiana Karchenko, I'm Bronwyn Benito, VOA News, Washington.
Check out what Mr. President Obama's house looks like on our website, voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. There's a new film starring Oscar nominees Viggo Mortensen and Frank Langella. It looks at the struggle between values and what's best for a family. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, Captain Fantastic has Mortensen playing a father who has to struggle with his idea of what it means to be a parent.
What we created here may be unique in all of human existence.
All the way to top!
We created a paradise.
Ben is a free spirit, a counterculture rebel who lives with his wife and six children in the woods in Washington State. He is rearing the kids with a rigorous intellectual and physical regimen, but he wants to turn them into bright, respectful adults. However, he has also kept them away from life outside their bohemian existence. That all changes when Ben's wife, Leslie, who has to be hospitalized for depression, commit suicide. Ben and the children want to attend her funeral, but her father, Jack, played by Frank Langella, refuses to allow it. Ben then faces a confrontation with Jack, and the kids experience a world they have never known. At the film's premiere in Los Angeles, Viggo Mortensen said that the movie explores not only what it means to be a parent, but also what defines a good parent.
I think it's always been hard. I don't think it's harder now than ever. I think it's always a question of what kind of parent you want to be. Do you want to be the kind of parent that says no because I said so, or do you want to be the kind of parent that says maybe not, and let me explain why? And if you have a counter argument, I'm willing to listen. That way is harder. It takes more time and energy, but it's worth it.
Captain Fantastic debuted at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year to great acclaim. It went on to win a directing prize of the Un Certain Regard section at Cannes for Matt Ross. Ross says that this film did have unique challenges, but he was pleased with the end product.
Every movie is difficult, and it's amazing that any movie is ever made. The particular logistical challenges in this movie were that there's six kids in every scene, there's two musical numbers, two stunts, both of which involve children. We're a road movie, so we're in different locations every single day.
Annalise Basso plays Ben's daughter, Vesper. She says the cast had to go through an outdoor boot camp to prepare for the film.
That was my first time really camping because we built our own shelter. And that I would say, is the craziest experience for me, just because it was totally nothing. All we had were sleeping bags, and we scavenged berries and plants from the woods, and for dinner that night we had that, and also someone brought salmon.
Captain Fantastic also stars Samantha Isler as Ben's daughter Keeler, and English actor George McKay as his son Bodovan. Captain Fantastic is rated R for language and brief nudity. It is set for release in the United States July 8th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And we thank you for listening to International Edition. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwean communities in the Yanga district will be able to construct facilities to dramatically improve their health and sanitation, thanks to assistance from the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and its Community Water Supply, Sanitation, Hygiene, and Natural Resources Management, also known as CWASH program. In early June, at the Ruronquo District Development Fund Rest Camp, Robert Shawatama, the Provincial Water and Sanitation Subcommittee Chairperson for Manicaland, officially handed over to the people of Nyanga District $40,000 in materials to construct or rehabilitate 83 boreholes, 45 pumps to extract water, 105 drinking troughs for animals, and 102 latrines. Chairperson Chawatama also presided over the graduation of 18 community latrine and water pan builders and 16 village pump mechanics who had been trained by Development Aid from People to People, or DAP Zimbabwe, with funding from USAID. With guidance from the District Development Fund, these builders and mechanics will assist the communities in constructing and repairing their water infrastructure and ensure long-term sustainability. In total, USAID's CWASH activities will provide safe and clean water to 2,400 households and six schools in the district. The communities of Nyanga North have long grappled with access to safe and clean water due to frequent breakdowns of boreholes. Some families travel for 10 kilometers to access safe water, while others sleep queuing for water at the boreholes. Many boreholes in the district are being chained and locked as communities try to safeguard limited water resources. Others have introduced strict water rationing, with households only allowed to collect 2 20-liter buckets per day, regardless of the household size. USAID is proud to support Nyanga District to improve access to safe, potable water, said USAID Zimbabwe Acting Mission Director Bruce Abrams. With this newly acquired technical expertise and building materials, these communities are now able to protect themselves against waterborne diseases.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.